Hello and welcome to Promenade Culture Center. This is Culture Corner. We bring you the authentic stories of creative individuals. Today with us, Eleanor Burton, Al Issa, Training and Relationships Manager at Envy. Eleanor, very warm welcome to Culture Corner.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I'm so happy you managed to find some time because busy, busy schedule. And we know each other for a while, so I'm sure that this will be, we wouldn't know where to start or where to end our conversation, but it just gives us a chance to see each other again. I wanted to start with you, with asking you a question we ask everyone who wasn't originally born in Kuwait. How did Kuwait happen for you, and when did you come to Kuwait?
Oh, okay, so Kuwait happened to me, or for me, mm-hmm. Because I met my husband in college in the United States. And then we got married and we ended up moving here in, it was after the war, we mm-hmm. moved here. And so that's how I actually ended up mm-hmm. living in Kuwait. So I'm from mountains mm-hmm. and... the places where I grew up hiking and skiing. So I said, I will never live in a place without mountains and trees and skiing. So that didn't come to pass because Fawaz is my husband is from a desert. I was like, why are you from a desert? But, you know, I've learned to really love a lot of aspects of Kuwait. Mm. And of course, the family here is, I have this beautiful Kuwaiti family here. Mm. And it's been really interesting living here.
I want us to go a little bit back into your first professional experiences. First of all, what did you study? Did you study what you're doing today?
I actually sort of knew what I wanted mm-hmm. to do. So I studied international relations mm-hmm. and linguistics as my undergraduate. Mm-hmm. But I was.
I love that.
Yeah, I was already very, very interested in intercultural communication and how that works. And I was also very interested in social justice work at a young age. So already in college, I was interested in that. So I always, the kind of work that I do now is the kind of work I always wanted to mm-hmm. do. And I've been really fortunate to sort of stay in that lane most of my work experience since I was in college. Actually, I was in theater conservatory before that. I went to theater conservatory mm-hmm. and I actually left it because a group from Guatemala came and did political theater mm-hmm. at the conservatory, and none of my classmates understood what it was, and I thought, oh, I'm in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And I changed colleges because I thought I am much more interested in what is happening in that political theater than I am in theater per se. And that was like a really a big shift for me. Yeah.
And you've spent a number of years in Turkey.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Working as an educator?
No.
Okay.
I was here with Amadis for 5 years, mm-hmm. working as the regional educational advising consultant for Amadis. So I worked all over the region, and I was working then with educational mm-hmm. advising and training the educational advisors in the Gulf. But then we moved to Turkey, and I worked with refugees mm-hmm. in a social service position, where I was working with urban refugees and asylum seekers. This was during a time when Turkey did not accept refugees directly. Mm-hmm. So it was quite tricky for people that had that was their first country that they'd come to fleeing their home countries. So I worked there in social services, and then I became the director for the U.S. government cultural orientation mm-hmm. program, which was over, I think it was at one point over 9 countries. So that was really helping. Well, we were helping build social services infrastructure in Istanbul and also throughout the governorates in Turkey. But we were also helping facilitate the resettlement of refugees to the United States. And I was doing cultural orientation. not for them to assimilate to the States, but for them to sort of survive that adjustment process, to think about what that would look like for them. And
for a lot of international organizations, we know that this connection with people in whose favor you're working sometimes does not exist. Everything ends up in an office in a lot of paperwork. Did you have a direct contact with people with whom you were working?
Oh, absolutely.
How were these experiences? I'm very curious.
You know, it's very moving to work. For me, I really like very hands-on community building work and field work. I love the challenge of working with a vulnerable population and being able to think about how do you knit together the resources of different organizations, communities, and entities so that they will collaborate to support people who are falling through the cracks, basically because either the legal framework or the social capital isn't there to support them in reaching their potential. Mm. So I love that. And but I think one of the lessons of the work when you start as a young person is you really need to know that you're doing the work because it reflects your values about how you want to live in the communities that you reside in, as opposed to wanting to receive something from the people in the programs that you work in. Mm. So I am very wary when I'm hiring people, and and this was true in Turkey. I never wanted to hire people that came in with sort of a like a savior complex, or I want to do this because it makes me feel good. Because there are going to be plenty of days when that work doesn't make you feel good. It's the joy in the work is because it's meaningful. You're doing work that reflects the values of how you think people should care for one another in the community and in the world. Those people might hate you while you're literally doing work to support them and their families. And that shouldn't matter. What should matter is, am I showing up in a way that's responsible and compassionate and, you know, has integrity, irrespective of how I feel about the person sitting in front of me? You know, am I being clear in my work? So I think Turkey was really, really good for that kind of learning experience. And I felt it very immediately, you know.
You moved back then to Kuwait.
Yeah.
And the next stop for you was Fawzia Sultan?
Yeah. Then I started working at Fawzia Sultan. Mm.
And that was a different role.
It was, but it was still... They have the same bones, right? Uh-huh. They might look different, but everything kind of has the same bones. So Fawzia Sultan was operating at that time as a nonprofit health clinic, and they were really trying to think about how do we create fair access for the care that we give to all different kinds of communities. So they would have their sort of for-profit piece that was, you know, for regular clients coming in, but they were very thoughtful about what if someone needs this care and access to this care but can't afford it. So I was working in that particular space of doing community projects and working. So I was on the first group. There were three of us, I think, on the first group to set up the Run Kuwait for Fawzia Sultan. And that was to raise money for the Center for Evaluation. What is it? The Child's Evaluation and Rehabilitation Center there. So that was to give access to people for care for children with disabilities who wouldn't have access to that care. Often the community that was served was non-Kuwaiti parents where both parents were working, but they can't send their kids to the government schools, so they have to also pay for school fees, and now they have a child with disability. And there just aren't the resources then for that support. So that's what we were supporting there. Again, I was always looking at how do we get... So in Turkey, I got all these organizations to work together that did not work together normally, so we could get education for children that were there waiting to be resettled or were asylum seekers. And then here it was a similar conversation that we were having. How do we look at the resources in the community and sort of knit together knowledge and the desire of people to collaborate in a way that can resource the people that maybe have less access and are most vulnerable in the community. So for me, I don't see a disconnect between the threads of the because again, the work is, the question is, am I living in a community in a way that's responsible to that community? Wherever you drop me.
Yes. I understand this. I fully understand this. We're coming now, we're going down that road of your different professional engagements, and we come to Envy. And that has happened 7 years ago, right? It's been
2017. Okay. November is when I started.
And the time has passed so quickly.
Yeah.
And there's so many that's happening in this organization and so many roles you have, I think, as all of you there, in different programs, in different capacity building for civil society. And it feels it is very unique in Kuwait. I did not come across anything similar. I would like for you to share as much as you can about the good work you're doing, primarily what you're doing, because that's an interesting point, but of course other programs and other things, because I think it needs attention.
I think that what makes us, what may make us feel unique is that all of the programs that we do emerge from conversations or data that we collect from the community. Mm-hmm. So it's always a question of what do people feel is their priority? And it's also very important that you're asking that question to everyone in the community. So the conversations that we're having about what do we envision Kuwait would look like as a resilient, compassionate community where everyone was cared for. Mm. What would that look like? We're not asking that to one group of people, because I think a lot of organizations might ask that kind of question, but they might, it's not just the question you ask, but who you ask it to. So the more people that you ask it to, the more inclusive your programs can be. Mm. So we're talking to people across nationalities, across socioeconomic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, people with very, very different kinds of lived experiences, people with very, very different types of access to power or justice in the community. So it's first about, as a team, are we listening? Are we asking the right people? Are we bringing the right people in? Are we then listening to what they say and then thinking about what are the emergent priorities people have? And then how do we respond by designing programs that will echo those things that people want to work on? So we're working a lot with some of the areas that have emerged as being really important since I started at Envy the education system, sort of reforming the education system, but more in terms of thinking about what kind of youth do we want to emerge from the education system. And so we had that, you were part of the coalition many years ago. And the question was essentially, who do we want to emerge? And we said, we want someone who emerges with the skills and the desire to make Kuwait a better place. So both of those things had to happen hand in hand. And then what would that education look like? Mm. And out of those questions, and we talked to everybody, you know, teachers and parents and people like yourself, people in community spaces,
government,
private sector, we started working on a program that we could offer to students to sort of build those critical thinking skills, social emotional intelligence, a way to be more compassionate and think about your accountability in your community and how you show up. So that was a SWATNA emerged from that. I think also are, which, so Aswatna is for youth, and it's really developing those critical thinking skills, storytelling skills, intercultural communication skills. And then they learn how to do participatory action research and go out and research their own community. We use a lot of models like that. We've done...
This is also, in a way, public advocacy?
Well, yes, because the programs that the students are working on inclusion in education. And so those are their key questions that they come up with to inquire about are emerging from what they notice about people being excluded in the school system or included. And those are the areas they work on. But we also work with migrant rights, with migrant communities on sort of...
Do you feel, sorry to interrupt you, yeah. Do you feel that now the community comes to you to search for help, support, answers?
Yes, yes. Mm. I mean, I think we have this funny place we reside because we talk to everybody. Mm. We're very curious about everybody. We're curious to know.
Best thing ever, curiosity.
Yeah, we're very curious. We're like the most curious group. I would say our team is super curious. Yeah. So people come to us all the time I get so many requests like, do you know someone who can provide like home support for my 6-year-old autistic child? Do you know someone who can help with this person that's working here and her indemnity wasn't paid? I mean, we get every kind of question. Yeah. And so, or do you know an organization that could help us build a mural that represents community values? So it's across everything. It's like arts.
We can help with that.
Yeah, it's across. But it's like that. It's like it's across disciplines. It's across communities. It's across. Yeah, it's across. It's across all kinds of ways that people can imagine kind of resourcing each other and trying to make quite stronger.
I realized recently when I came to one of your most recent events that the group is even more diverse than it was.
Oh, yeah.
And this is why I'm asking the question of community coming to you, because it feels like now you have that profile. Now people know what you do, in what fields you work, and you have, it's very positive what you've been doing. So the results of it just kind of are now dispersed in community, and community knows. And when I say unique, I mean I cannot name another organization that is a civil society organization, which I believe you are. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dealing with, for instance, with minority groups or rights, or you were just about to say something about that when I interrupted you.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to say. One is, it's not only the community comes to us for resources, but if you want to do community building work, you actually have to go and meet the community where they are. So I think our work has become more rigorous and more demanding. Mm. We're a very small team because you really need to go out to where the community is. And so
what does that look like, for instance?
I can give
your field work.
I can give you a quick example. We have a resiliency program, which is really helping to support migrant community groups who have people that advocate for the rights or the resources available to people that are working here as migrant workers, but in sort of lower paying or lower skilled jobs often. And then there's a lot of advocates working for that. And we had done a program with the Ethiopian Domestic Workers Association, and we needed to do sort of an evaluation of some of the work that had been done for their group. They're an amazing group. But the women that we needed to interview couldn't get off work till 10 p.m. at night. So that means that we're doing our assessments online with them from 10 to midnight, you know, in the middle of the night, because that's when the community is available. Mm. On our build project, where we were bringing in, again, like architects and artists and designers and students and activists and the different migrant community groups, like the Integrated Community Center, to include the migrant community. Because so when we do a project, we center like a project for students, we center the voice of students, a project for migrant workers, we center the voice of migrants. That meant we had people joining our design sessions on the phone while ironing at like 11 o'clock at night in their place of employment. Mm. You know, it's, and so I think some of the most vulnerable people in the community take great risks to really work on building out resources and capacity and resilience for their communities, you know, and it's, you have to really admire like the way the community steps into the work. But it doesn't just happen. You don't just suddenly have a multicultural community where people are connected and diverse. You do a lot of groundwork.
I've spent years in nonprofit sector. And even though I was mostly in philanthropy development field, I had very close relationships to colleagues who did, who dealt with social issues, with minority rights, with different things that remind me of your work that you're talking about now. And there's something interesting I learned. You don't make active communities. You support people be active in their communities, which is a big difference, I realized, working with these colleagues. And I know that the change does not come overnight. Mm-hmm. It takes so much time for first results to show. And a lot of times your very, very hard work and the hard work of these members of the community just kind of ends on the same note day by day until suddenly a change hopefully appears. How do you measure these results? And do you get to measure them? Has enough time passed for some of your projects and programs? What keeps you going as an organization?
I feel like actually it's a timely question. I started in 2017 and you'll probably remember when you were part of our meetups that we always say, this is a 20-year. Mm. We're looking at this on a 20-year timeline, right? Like you have to, you just keep going at it. You just keep building the community. You just keep engaging. You keep educating. You keep developing young activists. You just keep working at it. We can see it because we start to see other organizations use the tools of community engagement that we have. We see other organizations replicating things that we do. In our organization, that's a win. We don't have such a thing as don't do what we did. Mm. Don't claim something and take it off as your own and make it happen. No, go. Yeah. Take the tools. If you learned something that you can use and make your workplace better or your community better or whatever, go. Please, because that's what we want, right? You want that snowball effect. You want to start seeing it. And we are starting to see it. I think one of the exciting things is we were doing in Aswatna. Out at the end of the Aswatna program for youth, they had an ideathon and they designed community interventions, like projects that we gave seed funding to. One of them is the Nudge Club. The Nudge Club was conceived by these students to nudge the relationship between teachers in the Indian schools closer to the students. Mm-hmm. Because what came up in their conversations when they were thinking about education and inclusion, the Indian students said, in one of the conversations they were talking about their schools, they said, oh, the best teacher that we all like the most is so-and-so. And they were asked why. And they said, because they make eye contact with us. Mm. And we were like, oh. So these students said, let's create a club that brings together teachers and students. Now it's in like 5 of the big Indian schools. It's the Nudge Club. The kids belong to it. The teachers belong to it. It's amazing the work they're doing. And we, to engage the teachers and get them on board, we did a whole teacher community meetup series, and those are going on. So they brought the teachers on board. Mm. Teachers were like, oh, we're going to use this stuff in our classrooms. And then they brought on community members who are willing to be Nudge Club facilitators. And they have a full schedule. And it's like, so it's kind of like happening at scale. We have a program now with KIPCO called Imbots. Mm-hmm. It's their program now. We just support them. But it came out of some of these principles of not just school to work, which is what the program is for new graduates. It's not like we want to shape you for the corporate world. It's like we want you to be resilient, adaptable, creative, a good communicator when you go into the real, honest-to-goodness, multicultural learning corporate environment here. Can you survive it? Can you navigate it? Do you know who you are? Are you able to critically think about power dynamics in the workplace? Are you able to be accountable for your work? Can you take risks? Can you show up? These are the questions we're asking everybody. But now it's existing in the corporate sphere. We have the same conversation existing in the across a number of the Indian schools. Within the migrant community, we are seeing the leaders from there. You know, our role is simply to kind of listen and provide support for whatever their organizations need, and they're just doing amazing work. You know, in their field. And so we're there in a supportive stance for that work as well. And we're seeing that work get stronger and better as well.
In our line of work here, one of the hardest thing, so the cultural, the capital is there, but finding people who would want to be engaged with you as an instructor or, a facilitator or a teacher or just simply to do something else, is quite difficult. Also employing people, finding people is difficult. How do you find all of these people who work on your programs, who you rely on, especially among younger generation? What is the secret recipe?
I think that the relationships that we build with people are not transactional.
Mm-hmm.
They're relationships that happen. If someone calls you at 11 o'clock at night, we are present and we invest very authentically and deeply in the relationships that we have with the community. People feel that and they know that. The work that we do has meaning and it reflects what the community has said that they want. Mm-hmm. So people are attracted to it because people are looking for meaning. One of our partners said something very insightful. We were doing a community mapping where we put these big maps of Kuwait out and people would map their emotional relationships to different spaces in Kuwait and places they felt safe and didn't feel safe to kind of think about that, you know. And then she said, oh, I want to go off and I want to do my focus group. I want them to be people with small, medium enterprises here, youth. And we were like, what? What? They're going to think this is like such a weird sociological research. Why would they? And she said, I should give her credit, Arij. Shout out to Arij from Art Scene. She said, no, I think a lot of youth have small, medium enterprises here because it's a space that they can, that's socially acceptable mm-hmm. for them to be in, where they can create meaning. You know, they can do something that feels meaningful and creative, but it's also acceptable. So she said, I think it's a really interesting community to talk to. So I think it's about that. I think it's about people's desire for connection, desire for meaning. People come to the Awaken Festival. You know the Awaken Festival? Yeah, the big festival we have in the desert. And it's all about connection. It's just...
to be heard, to be seen.
Yeah.
To be appreciated.
Yeah.
I was reminded of that at the event I came to the other day because you were asking us difficult questions, as you always do. No, they were. It was not difficult, but they were poignant and had a deeper meaning. And it was lovely sharing with people. It feels difficult at the first moment, and then it's really great. And so many different stories. I think we are not aware of the richness of diversity we're in here.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that yesterday. I was thinking about how so many people here travel for the experience of other cultures. You know, I travel all the time. I take all my breaks. I travel. I go on this amazing thing. I went to Nepal, whatever. In certain places in the world, the richness of this multicultural history we have in Kuwait And all the things that are available to you if we weren't in silos would be celebrated. Yes. I mean, if you dig around in Kuwait, there's a million different things going on in different communities that are fascinating. But we're very invisible to one another. Yeah. We're very siloed. We're very insular in our own communities.
Do you think we impose this on ourselves? Or the circumstances are such? Kind of like censorship and auto-censorship. Do you think we cannot reach out to the other group?
I think it's almost a lack of imagination. And a lack of exposure, and also the messages people are sent growing up and told about other communities. I remember sitting with someone, this lovely young woman, and saying, she was talking to me. She was from Kerala, talking to me about setting up women's businesses. And we had a lovely conversation. And at some point she was like, why are you in Kuwait? And I said, oh, my husband's Kuwaiti. And she said, and she gasped, but the reaction was fear. Fear. And I said, what is happening for you? Like when I say that, and she said, oh, I'm sorry. That seems scary to me. And I said, have you ever had a conversation with someone who's Kuwaiti? And she said, no, never. She said, and even it was just such a scary thought for her. But then, you know, we had a friend who came to Awaken, and at Awaken, the Bohra community, we host this, it's called Namak, this beautiful shared meal for like the 200 people that come to the desert, and everyone sits at thals, which are the trays of food, and you will have 8 people at each thal, and we do it randomly, so no one's sitting with people they know, and we have prompts for them, and they talk. And our friend was saying, I really want to be a part of designing Awaken, because that experience for me of being the guest, he said, it wasn't just meeting people from this community that I've grown up next to my whole life. He's a Kuwaiti guy. He said, I was not only meeting them, I was their guest. I was participating in a meal that they were hosting and learning about it and having these conversations. And it basically defied every kind of stereotype or thing that he had learned growing up, you know, in his context. And it was very, it shifted him. It was very powerful for him. I mean, we get these stories all the time of these small moments. You know, our stories telling what we use everywhere is very powerful for people. They'll be like, it's the first time I spoke to someone from here. I shared a story I've never shared with anyone,
but
with this
person.
But
human contact is so different from learning it from books.
Yeah.
Reading about it, even researching on it. There's nothing without that live contact with people.
Yeah.
Given how challenging and daring some of these topics are that you constantly work with, how do you rest? I ruin everyone with this question. It's my favorite question. Because I firmly believe in this, and I have started applying certain things to rest, because there's no creation without rest. You cannot, and my job is to create constantly from scratch. And I've been doing it since the early days. So we must rest. Now, how do you do it? Do you think you do it in order to be able to go back full strength to all of these assignments? Because contact with people fulfills us. It also drains us. It's very normal.
Yeah.
There's nothing negative about it. It is what it is. I'm not asking for anything specifically private. Honestly, people share here whatever they want to share. But do you think you find that time to rest and recuperate?
I think I'm really bad at it.
Very, very good for you to admit that.
Yeah, I think
that's actually very good. It's a step forward.
Well, I do a lot of the design work of all these different curriculums. Mm. And if I have to think about them, I'm getting worse at it as I get older. I kind of half lucid dream or something, like I'll be trying to sleep, and then whatever design thing I'm trying to work through will become part of my dream. And I'll actually have to wake up and write stuff down, because I've realized now that I solve a lot of stuff that way, but it's not really healthy. And our team is small. Our team is so small. I mean, we have a lot. I think we've got like 10 projects ongoing right now. Mm. And then those projects shift every couple of years, you know, and they evolve, and we're doing other stuff, and we're holding the relationships in the community and doing outreach and stuff.
The community is getting bigger with every project.
So I can answer this. Okay. So personally, I'm bad at it. Professionally, and in terms of our community, it has been amazing in the last couple of years, because we have trained so many people to train. Mm. We have so many brilliant facilitators. We have brilliant design partners. So we are more and more resourced, which is how it's supposed to happen, as the community is more and more committed collectively to this work. So this is what you think about when you're doing like movement building. Like, so it becomes something that fabric becomes much more cohesive, and people carry their relationships that they've maybe have been melded in some experience we've facilitated. They carry those out of that. And now they're working over here in those relationships. They're doing their own thing. It's strengthening what we do over here. Yeah. So that's amazing for helping us hold our work. Mm. Yeah, we could not do the work we did without all the other people holding the work. Our work is like, just depends on everybody in the community. It does not exist without that.
Storytelling is an immense part of what each program holds, communication. I wanted to ask you about this because we overuse this word storytelling, but also it is so important, and it is so, has so many beautiful layers and depth. Is there anything, I know that you publish work and I know that you publish research, and it's available to the public, but do you ever think of creating a whole festival on storytelling of these stories, great stories that you've covered and great stories that people from communities carry? Or a publication or anything that's, you know.
Well, we have an oral histories project that we did during COVID, and that's online. So
I was listening to that.
Yeah, so those stories are available for educators to use or for people to interact with. We also... Our second Awaken was a storytelling residency, actually, where different members of the community crafted stories over a long time, and then they came and they presented them on the main stage to sort of highlight different types of experience. So every program has what we call storytelling within it. Because it's a way for people to genuinely, authentically connect with one another. And for the work that we do to be effective, people have to be quite present and vulnerable and open to it. So I would say, I don't know, maybe all of our festivals and things are... People are sharing stories in all of the work. We don't call it a storytelling festival per se.
But it is. It's in its essence. Yeah.
In its essence, it's like trying to get people to connect on a very heartfelt level. We know we sometimes talk about the fact that if you were to just reduce the work down to one word, it would be love, which sounds very, you know, cringy to people, but it is actually about that. It's like, how do you care for each other? You know, how do you care about each other? How do you learn to care about each other? How do you show up for each other?
I really believe in this. When my eldest daughter was a little girl and she taught herself to write, she would end anything she was drawing or writing with, "Love is the most important."
Mm-hmm.
And it was so funny because it sounds funny, and it was correct grammatically, but also there was like some things missing, you know? You want to say love is the most important thing of all or something, you know? And she would just have this. And then years later, we realized how great that was, that sentence. And now we use it still all the time, you know? When we are really feeling low or want to say something about something, we just say, oh, but the love is the most important thing. And it is. So I fully understand that. Everything is in those four letters.
Because that's where, think about, you know, I always ask this question, like, when were you brave enough?
Yeah.
When were you brave enough to use your voice for something, you know, for yourself or for someone else? When were you brave enough to act? When were you brave enough to show up in that kind of way?
How incredible thing it brings when you are brave enough.
Yeah.
It takes only one time to see the whole world behind that.
Right. And you don't, and it feels so, I think for a lot of people before that moment, it feels impossible. Yes. It feels scary. You know, it's why you have bystanders. Mm. They don't want to be, but they're too scared. But when you love someone or you have love towards that person or care toward that person, is like part of my community. There's someone that I am also responsible for. I don't even have to like the person, actually, to feel that responsibility. Like,
or even know the person.
Or know the person. I'm responsible for this other person, this other human in front of me. What am I going to do about it? Like, you know, how am I going to show up? And that could be showing up in just the momentary kindness in your interaction, which we thought about a lot in the Awaken Festival this year. Like, how do you move through the world? But yeah, I think resiliency then is very tightly tied to that.
Yes, to that.
I think that all those things, love and community and resiliency, you don't have resiliency without that.
And being, for children especially, I always insist whenever I get an information from school that my kids have shown emotion, whatever that, you know, means, I ask the teachers to support this. They don't have to be perfect little robots showing different emotion. Just being in touch with them helps create a kind person in the future, helps strengthen or empower the resilience within us.
Yeah, and part of resiliency is also knowing that you can ask for help.
Yeah.
And knowing that you can fail and all of those things that are super hard for people. Mm. Really,
and
really,
all depending on certain cultures, almost impossible.
Yeah. I remember us doing some work at one of the universities, and it was with like 20-year-olds. Yeah, they're about 20 years old. And they were super like, they're like, is this political science or therapy? I mean, it was just, we were like, this is going to be a hard ask to have these conversations. But at the end of the day, because they had done some storytelling in the, you know, they'd shared some stories about some things. I can't remember the theme of it. But when they were reflecting at the end, they had finally totally engaged, actually, and they were reflecting at the end. One of the young men was talking about, yeah, this was really different to have these conversations. And we were asking why, you know, what, and he said, well, they're not really acceptable for men. Mm. I remember there were nine young men in a row. And then there were the girls, they had segregated themselves by their chairs. And the men were saying, they were all shaking their head, yeah. And I said, so what's acceptable? And he says, anger, humor, talking about maybe politics a little bit or sports. Mm. But expressing joy, expressing appreciation for something, talking about something that's difficult to deal with, none of that would be acceptable form of masculinity, you would have that conversation with one person in your life. And so they were talking about, and then the girls were talking also about sort of the mujamala, the way that you have to appease people socially and perform socially in a particular way that doesn't allow for certain kinds of interactions. Mm-hmm. So really investigating, you know, what are the cultural norms that you're
and why within. So many of them are joyless.
Yeah. And hard, and hard. They leave people very isolated, and they're across all different cultures. You know,
obviously,
we have
yes.
we have this in all different cultures. These things which teach us, kind of, it's a very fear, sort of fear based and very performative. That isn't very helpful for building community.
What is in plans for your organization these days? Obviously, your current projects that you're carrying out. Are there any, like, interest? Everything is interesting, actually. I want to find the right word. Anything new, exciting, maybe, in the horizon?
Yeah. So one thing we're starting is a 3-year project called Thrive. We're looking at disability justice. So if you have the opportunity to look at disability justice and some of the videos online and stuff, things that are written, it's like the most inclusive way to think about a community of people. It's how do you do everything with thinking about making it accessible to as many people as you can in the most reasonable way. And we've been thinking about that in our work. It feels very aligned to our work. And so this will be a program where we're working with different folks from the disabled community who will then participate in training on critical thinking, participatory action research, disability justice. They'll go out and do mapping of their communities, see what are the key needs in the community, what kind of, and then they'll come up with interventions, very similar to our other programs. So it's all about sort of resourcing communities to work on the things that are important to them. So that's going to be, and then we have some small projects on social entrepreneurship. We have another AI and assistive technology is one of our small projects. Mm-hmm. We have, We're working on something right now towards something called the Hearth Summit, which are these international summits that are on well-being. They do talk a lot about intergenerational trauma, but it's really thinking again about some of these basic tenets of how you live in a wholehearted, caring, nurturing kind of community in place, and how does that look like, and how does that happen? So that would probably be maybe affiliated with Awaken next year. We're doing some training with some folks that work with the migrant community, helping them on any kind of claims or issues that they're having with the government, a little bit of that. And we've got some other stuff.
Schedule.
I mean, that's the ones that are upcoming, not the ones that we have right
that
now.
That you already are running,
yes. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So busy schedule. We'll be happy to support you if we can. Please keep in touch.
Yeah.
And our time passed really quickly. So we'll have to meet again and speak more and see each other in the community.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
I'm always happy to see you when you show up. That's good.
I hope to be involved more. I've had a very challenging and busy year, as many have, obviously.
Yeah, this year.
Yes. There's a lot of hope shared today between us and a lot of expectations of great results and great social changes.
I hope so.
Here's to that. Thank you so much, Eleanor.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you soon.
Okay.